This year is the 200th anniversary of the 1820 settlers, and you would expect to be many major events to commemorate this. Certainly we're going to do so in the Reformation Society, but the 1820 settlers, 200 years ago, this is the 200th commemoration of the arrival of approximately 4,000 British settlers in South Africa. They came from the four corners of the British realm, from England, Scotland, Ireland and Wales. So often people speak about the English settlers. No, they came from Scotland, Ireland and Wales too, and people confuse England with the British Isles. It's like thinking everyone in South Africa is from the Free State. There are four major provinces here, and there are four states, nations that make up the British Isles too. These 1820 settlers played a vital role in the development of this country. The 1820 settlers were several groups of British settlers invited by the governments of the United Kingdom and the Cape to move to the Eastern Cape in 1820. Now, they came under false pretenses. They thought they were getting 100 acres of land in a land of plenty and peace and all of that as a reward for their work in the Napoleonic War. Because many of these men had fought in the Napoleonic Wars, and Britain experienced a serious unemployment problem. And so the 1820 settlers, at least the men amongst them, were generally veterans of the wars, some of whom had fought all the way through the war and bore the scars in their bodies. And now, as a reward, they were getting a chance to be landowners in Africa, and they had no idea what the government was doing. They're throwing them into the middle of a war zone because they didn't want to deploy soldiers there. And so they conned these poor people into thinking that they were going to be farmers and landowners, whereas actually they were going to be a buffer for the frontier wars. In 1819, the British government received more than 90,000 applications from British citizens who wanted to move to South Africa. Not that they knew what they were doing, but the discussions about all this took part in St. Stephen's Chapel and the Speaker's House in Westminster on the Thames, and this was the appearance of the old House of Commons before it was destroyed in the fire of 1834, and then the present Palace of Westminster was built. This is how the 1820 immigration scheme was ridiculed in the press in London. And you can see these people being eaten alive by cannibals. That's basically, they were saying, you know, are you crazy? Are you mad? Are you out of your mind? This is insane and all the rest of it. So plainly, there were those in Britain who did not think this was a great idea. The Cape government encouraged the settlers to live in the Eastern Cape in an attempt to strengthen the eastern frontier against the neighbouring Khoisan tribes who were attacking, and to provide a boost to the English-speaking population of South Africa. In fact, the 1820 settlers were part of the British government's policy of Anglicisation. They tried to move the Cape from Dutch as the primary medium of communication to English, and obviously for that they needed some English speakers. Into the 1820 settlers. Now here we've got artistic depiction from the newspapers at the time of immigrants who are on their way to Canada, but this is all part of the great 19th century migration of millions of Europeans sick with war, 25 years of the French Revolution and Napoleon Wars, wanted to get out of Europe. And you had the same thing after the Second World War. A lot of people just enough already, and they were moving to Canada, Australia, America, and some to South Africa, although the South African government made it hard for people to move here. But still, there's this kind of attitude of Europe is just a continent of war, and there were people who came to Africa thinking they were going to find some peace. Here's the East Indian, one of the transport ships provided by the Royal Navy, and she sailed from Cork with about 220 settlers on board. Now, this is the way artists depicted their accommodation, very communal, worse than barracks. And I think it sort of must remind one of prison conditions. This is not exactly the way you may think of pleasure cruises or the Titanic or something like that. Now, this is later, about 20 years later, showing communal quarters for married couples on the best type of immigrant ships. This is like first class in the 1840s. Spacious bunks, broad tables, reasonable headroom, great improvements on what was experienced by the 1820 settlers. They did not come over in ships giving them this good accommodation. It was more like that. Porto Praia, an island of St. Largo, one of the Cape Verde Islands, a welcome port of call for the settlers that took on fresh water here on the way. Now, when you cross the equator, there's always got to be a ceremony, and so traditional Royal Navy ceremony of crossing the equator, especially landlubbers who hadn't crossed the equator before got initiated with some seamen climbed over onto on board pretending to be Neptune, normally with a mop as hair and things like this, and then they dunked the people who were landlubbers or those who had never crossed the equator before, initiating them for crossing the equator. And I vaguely remember that happened to me as a young boy, and certainly seen pictures of it when we went on Pendennis Castle. There is a tradition that continued for many years. On the 17th of March 1820, the Nautilus and the Chapman sailed into Table Bay with the first of 60 groups of British settlers who made up the 1820 settlers. And most of the 1820 settlers arrived in the Cape between April and June 1820, 60 different shiploads. At that time, Lord Charles Somerset, after which Somerset West is named, was governor of the Cape of Good Hope from 1814 to 1827. So that's very unusual to have had a governor here as long. Normally the problem was governors came to the Cape, rigid European ideas, didn't understand Africa, clashed with the local people, and just by the time they were starting to learn the ropes and to understand well enough to do the job, they were relocated by the British somewhere else. And so the settlers were in a perpetual state of frustration with administration. But Lord Somerset stayed long enough to actually understand the people and to come around to reality. Most of what we know about the Cape from the past, we get from Lady Anne Barnard, who was born Lady Anne Lindsay, eldest daughter of James, Earl of Balcarres, and wife of Andrew Barnard, first Cape Colonial Secretary. So he was number two under the governor. And so Lady Anne Barnard, because the governor of the Cape at that time did not have his wife with him, Lady Anne Barnard served the role of First Lady. And she wrote prodigiously, and she drew and sketched and painted even more elaborately. And most of what we know about the Cape, we know from Lady Anne Barnard, because the men were very sparse with the details. You don't get much detail from Jan van Riebeeck and others about what was going on around here. They're very short on detail. Lady Anne Barnard, she became the hostess at the castle, and even to this day they call the dining room upstairs Lady Anne Barnard's room, because she would entertain, and if you've ever counted, there's 104 chairs, by the way, around the tables down the center here in the castle. She traveled widely with her husband, all the way to Swellen Dam and Rafiesonden, Storms Flay, Montague and Robertson and Worcester, and up to Tilbach and Porterville, all the way through to Langebaan. So she knew, and she drew, and she put in verse and described what the Cape was like at that time. And amongst the things that is most fascinating is that she pointed out there was no forest in the Cape between Hout Bay and Knysna Forest. Newlands Forest was sown by the British later. In fact, the British were complaining that one of the biggest problems they had at that time was their road to Stellenbosch disappeared several times a year under the sea sand. And so they went on a wild tree planting spree and changed the whole ecosystem of the Cape. So that the Cape, which was very sparsely wooded and provided very little rainfall, could barely provide for 24,000 people living in Cape Town. And only because of the millions of trees planted from this time on, from the British occupation of 1795 on, did you actually get the chance that Cape Town could support millions of people under our present water system. So Lady Anne Barnard did hundreds of sketches and paintings. And if you've got access to one of these watercolors and sketches books, you're a very blessed person. In fact, when they went to restore the castle, and was one of the six South African infantry captains who was part of our prayer group, who became Commandant Cochran at the castle, under him from 1980s, they started to restore the castle to its original, and they realized we've got the paint wrong, we've got this and that wrong, and they were going to Lady Anne Barnard's watercolors to rectify the damage done over the years and to bring it back to the way the castle used to be. And so designing and describing, and this is one of the, if you want to see some of these pictures, you've got to visit the Vineyard Hotel in Newlands, and a lot of her pictures or prints of them are there. And you can see now Paradise. Anyone know where Paradise was? Anyone on the GCC's been to Paradise? It's in Newlands Forest, Lady and Barnard had a cottage up there, which is sadly now ruins, and they were planting trees wildly there, and that was where the woodcutter and others stayed. And so the whole of the Cape at that time, here she would be on top of the governor's mansion in the castle and painted this panorama, for example. And here you can see again from the top of the castle a view of what Cape Town looked like at that time. And again, you can see a river coming down the center. It's been shown that Cape Town has 26 springs in front of Table Mountain. Underneath, they've got a massive reservoir or underground lake under where Parliament is. And millions of liters of pure mountain spring water is just being ushered through our gutter system into the Table Bay Harbour without being used at all, without being harnessed. And during our water restrictions, it was pointed out by many that for years they've been telling City Council, why don't you make use of this fresh spring water from the mountain, which has just been paved over. And it's all flowing under Cape Town. And we don't need to have water restrictions if we just utilize the water that we're getting from Table Mountain anyway. So these are some of the lovely watercolors and paintings of Lady and Bond. But notice, next to no trees on Signal Hill at this stage. That came later. But you get a bit of a good view here of what Cape Town looked like. Right here you can actually see when Holy Trinity actually had its church steeple downtown, right close to where the city hall is now, the old city hall and the castle. But that was dismantled to make space for the parade ground and all of the rest, and they moved it further up into town. This, the new theatre, was the primary theatre, as in where they would have plays, and it's in Riebeck Square. Now, you've all seen it. Do you know what it's called today? No. What the building's, it's called St. Stephen's. It's the only Dutch form church in the world, I'm told, that is named after a saint. Because Dutch form churches don't tend to be named after a saint. And the reason is, when it became a church, the people of Cape Town stoned the building. And so they called it St. Stephen's after the first Christian martyr was stoned by the mob. And so that is a Dutch form church called St. Stephen's because the people stoned it. They were so angry that their theatre had been turned into a church. But anyway, this is a watercolour by Lady Anne Barnard. And again, just showing you what the slopes of the mountain looked like. Again, you can see she's drawing this from the castle. She's sitting on the castle walls, and you can see some of the castle walls around it and one of the chimneys, giving a perspective of the mountain before it was majorly forested. And you've probably been this way on your way to Worcester. Now, some of you have been to this location. This is the Vineyard, which was also one of the homes of the Barnards. And today it's, of course, been expanded dramatically. It's one of the most popular hotels in Cape Town. It's the Vineyard Hotel, which was the private residence of the Barnards, Lady Anne Barnard and her husband, who's the colonial secretary. So this has got one of the most magnificent views, and they've got the best collection I know of Lady Anne Barnard sketches, paintings, and artwork in their hallways, well worth a visit, with a matchless view of the side of Table Mountain and some of the route that we take on Great Commission courses. So she is commemorated on coin. There are books on the diaries of Lady Anne Barnard. She was not here for long, but she is the primary historian and artist of the early Cape history. Some of the early British settlers, if you could call a missionary a settler, who came before the 1820 settlers, Robert Moffat came in under the London Missionary side in 1816, and his chief work was at the Kuruman Mission Station in Northern Cape amongst the Tswana people, the Bechuanas, which today are the Tswana. He mastered their language. He translated the scriptures into it. In fact, he had the privilege of translating and printing the first Bible in African language, the Tswana language, the whole Bible. And what he did was phenomenal in that area. 54 years he worked in Africa as a missionary, and amongst other things, he shared the gospel with Mzilikazi and his son Lubengula, king of the Matabele. And one of his sons became a missionary to the Matabele and set up the first mission station, Matabeleland, where I grew up. And his daughter Mary married David Livingstone. Now, his son-in-law is more famous than he is, but Robert Moffat was a great missionary. The extent of the Cape Colony in 1820 is shown here by sketches of Reverend John Campbell of the London Missionary Society's tours in 1819 and 1820. So you can see, interesting, basically you've got not much between Cape Town, Stellenbosch, Swellendam, and you've got Graaffreinet is getting started up there. That's the frontier town, Graaffreinet. And wandering bushmen. Bushmen. Then you've got warriors over in what you call Transkei. So, desert. And in fact, it's called the Great Southern Desert over there. Reverend Dr. John Phillips also arrived earlier than the 1820 settlers. He arrived in the Cape in 1819 as a representative of the London Missionary Society again, same mission that sent out David Livingstone later. He returned to England in 1826 for just over 3 years, published researches in South Africa, not as well known as David Livingstone's missionary travels and researches in Southern Africa. His advice was much sought by politicians and philanthropists, and he is considered something of a busybody and a troublemaker. The military station at Algoa Bay, what do we call Algoa Bay today? Port Elizabeth, yeah, right. So in 1799, General Dundas, who had been campaigning against the Graaffreinet rebels trying to declare independence in the east of the colony, ordered a blockhouse to be made in Cape Town and shipped to Algoa Bay, prefab basically. He directed it should be erected near the beach to command both the landing and the ford over the Buchans River, and on the hill behind he ordered the erection of another blockhouse to be surrounded by a massive square stone redoubt named Fort Frederick of the Duke of York, Commander-in-Chief of the British Army. So the Chapman's the first ship of the 1820 settlers to arrive in Algoa Bay, travelling from Table Bay to Algoa Bay, put to anchor on the night of the 9th of April, 1820. And so, on the morning of the 10th of April, 1820, the first settlers start to be landed at Algoa Bay. And of course, you've got to understand, there were no jetties, no piers. You got into rowboats and you were rowed over the surf. And if you've done surfing, you know that it's not nice in a rowboat to try and go over that sort of thing. That's why they're trying to stabilize these boats with three together. And the 1820 settlers landing in Algoa Bay, and this has got to be quite terrifying for people who came from some village in England and were not sea people but landlubbers, and that's the only way they could get off the boat and get ashore. Captain Moresby of the HMS Menai supervised the landing of the settlers at Algoa Bay with efficiency and compassion and thoughtfulness, and a lot of people were grateful for his help. And this became one big tent city, but just think of the logistics involved in this, the amount of ships and the amount of tents and transports. The British government in the Cape organized Dutch farmers to be contracted to convey the settlers from Algoa Bay to their locations where they're going to get this 100 acres of farm. And processions of as many as 90 wagons at a time. Can you imagine when each wagon is pulled by 16 oxen? This is a big operation. Major operation to move them away from this tent town on the beach. And if you've been to Algoa Bay, you know how windy it can get there too. And on the sand, you can just imagine people getting sand blown in their faces all the time. This is an interesting map at the time, getting you an idea of what the Cape was like in 1785. So you had Cape Town and Stellenbosch being the second city built in South Africa, named after Simon van Stellen, and Swellendam. Now you've got to go quite a way to get something else. You get Graaffreinet. That's the frontier town. That's the ultimate end of civilization. Beyond this is just your life's in your hands kind of thing. But Algoa Bay is where they're now going to plant these settlers along the Great Fish River. They don't know, but they've been thrown in the middle of a war zone with their families. The settlers initially settled as farmers near the town Bathurst in the Eastern Cape. You can see these little green dots. That's where their farms were. The settlers' farms were parceled out along there. And they are being put in harm's way, actually. The settlement policy led to the establishment of Albany, a center of British diaspora in Africa. When you think that we only had about 300 Huguenots come in 1688, mainly to friendship, out of which the Huguenot heritage grew. They say that something in the region of 20% of Afrikaans bloodline is Huguenot today from those people. You can imagine 4,000 British settlers at this key time 200 years ago, how many descendants they've got today, how far the influence goes. The settlers' route from Elgo Bay to Assegai Bush, there's the Assegai Bush, from there they separate to go down to Salem or up to Grahamstown and to Bathurst and all the way through to Fort Perdy. Maybe some of you have been to these areas. I've been to all these places along here. And they were moving from Algoa Bay up that route. So the N2 that we know, that's not the way they would have been traveling. They were granted farms near the village of Bathurst, Eastern Cape, supplied with equipment and food against their deposits. In other words, they had to pay to come out, and what they got, even the land they got, they weren't given, even though it was meant to be a reward for their faithful service in the wars against the French, they had to pay it back over years with the produce. So they were basically indentured labor for the British to pay them back, just like when the Huguenots arrived in Frontier. They weren't given anything, right down to the shovels that they had to purchase on credit from the company, the VOC. They had to pay back over years, every single thing. So nobody got anything for free. No such thing at that stage. This is what Grahamstown looked like some time after the settlers arrived. Absolutely extraordinary, because there wasn't much there before. But most of the 1820 settlers were not farmers. They were soldiers, they were gunsmiths, they were blacksmiths, there were all sorts of things, tailors and so on. But farmers was somehow or another not one of the things that they particularly recruited people from, because most farmers were still running their farms in England. So what they needed out here were farmers, and what they got were townspeople in many cases who had to learn how to be farmers the hard way by trial and error. And so many of them abandoned the agriculture and quickly withdrew to Bathurst and settlements like Grahamstown, East London and Port Elizabeth, where they typically reverted to their trades, because farming is hard work, as anyone who's been a farmer knows. That's not what the average city person knows how to handle. And here's the sketch submitted by the government surveyor, Knobel, in June 1814 for the plan of Grahamstown. And that's High Street. We all know High Street. For those of us who've been to Grahamstown many a time, and of course, Terence studied at Rhodes University, which is just at the top here. And 6th South African Infantry Battalion was on the hill on this side, and the 1820 settlers' monuments up there. But this is the first plans. And on the spot stood the tree under which Lieutenant Colonel Graham and Captain Stockenstrom decided upon the present site of the city of Grahamstown in 1812. Now, Captain Stockenstrom, sadly, just a short while after this, was killed and eaten by the local Khoisan people while at a peace negotiation discussion. So this happened years before our dear Gullible's Travels, Piet Retief, went to Dingaan's kraal at Ungunvungluv and left his rifles outside the kraal. He should have learned from Stockenstrom's experience, but apparently did not. Deceived by the government into believing they were migrating to a peaceful land of plenty, that's the way it was advertised, they were in fact being used as a buffer between the Boers on the one side of the Great Fish River and the Khoisan on the other, who were battling non-stop over the cattle-rich country known as the Zureveld. They had multiple frontier wars here. And these poor souls and their families were being put right in the line of fire, so that they had no idea that just about everything they built up was going to be raided and burned down in a very short order. And this is how the settlers were depicted initially. Wide-brimmed hats make sense. Long muskets, fair enough. Long pipes, not good for your health, but I don't suppose they knew that then. Life on the frontier was very harsh. At this stage, the prevailing reality, remember, we're talking about 1820. Shaka is running the greatest military empire Africa's ever seen, south of the Sahara, in Zululand, and the Kingdom of Zululand. And one of his generals, Mzilikazi, has fallen into disfavor, and he's broken away a whole group of Zulus who become the Madibili. And they've rampaged across what today is Natal and the Free State and Transvaal, and wiped out something in a region of 156 tribes, exterminated millions of people in what's called the Mifikan or the Difikan. And as a result of this, there's a vast amount of survivors of tribes who's fleeing, living in the bushes and the caves. Some rally into Lesotho, what becomes later the Basutoland area, under Meshesheri, and they've used the mountain redoubts as protection. But others, known as the Manatisi or the Manati, flee, and these are the ones who are often coming to white settlements, farms, wanting work and protection from the Matabele or the Zulu. And there's not much difference between Zulu and the Matabele, except Zulu are settled in KwaZulu, but the Matabele are on the move, just continually attacking and moving. And at this stage, they weren't north of the Limpopo River yet, being the problem of the Rhodesians later, but they were a clear and present danger to everybody in what today is the Orange Free State and the Eastern Cape. And so many of these fled to mission stations. And so Reverend James Archbell, a Wesleyan missionary, had been accepted by Chief Moroko and the Barolong refugees who were survivors of the Matabele Mafeking. And his mission station at Tabanaku was a sanctuary for Sarel Siliers and his people after they were attacked by the Matabele at the Battle of Fekop, 1836. In 1843, James Archbell built the first church in Durban, a wattle and daub structure, thatched roof. He preached there until he moved to Pietermaritzburg, 1847. Well, this is the Tabanchu mission station church service. So here's an improvised yoke made for carrying pails, made from a suitably forked branch. How do you move a whole lot of heavy things? Well, these people had to be innovative, and this is their pails. A wheelbarrow made by Thomas Holden Barker, used on a farm Tharfield in 1824. The axle, the bolts on the lower strut, the band around the wheel are all iron. The washers on either side of the wheel are tin. Improvised wheelbarrows, but it worked. For many settlers, a sledge was at first the only means of carrying heavy loads. Sled similar to this one, or more frequently a triangular sled made of roughly lopped logs, can even be seen to this day around Khoza and Pondo villages. And I've even got a picture of our Bibles being moved on a sled in Angola, pulled by oxen, because the ground was so soft and so sandy we had trouble walking and carrying heavy loads, and so we had oxen pulling our Bibles on a sled. We're talking about 1990s now. So here's a homemade plow made at Tharfield, the home of Miles Barker and his wife, and the selecting and shaping of a suitable tree stump for the mouldboard and the fitting of the hand-beaten iron share. And this is iron. It just shows considerable ingenuity. Two holes at the end of the beam for harnessing the plow. So you can just imagine today with vehicles and hardware stores and all the different things we've got, one can't imagine what it's like for people who've got to make everything. Every single tool, soap, candles, everything you need. Your clothes, your repairs, everything's got to be done. These people have to be completely self-sufficient or in a community enough that they could barter and trade so that maybe one was better at the one thing and others at others. But you all had to be making things continually with your hand just to survive. Here's a settler starting to plow the earth, which has lain undisturbed since the days of Noah, describing from the diaries. His African hand wields a shambok over the backs of longhorn cattle, who were indeed as wild as bucks. The first African laborers employed by the settlers in 1823 were refugee Mantatisi from the north, people who had fled the Mifakan of Mzilikazi's Matabele. So trotting oxen and pack oxen were used by the indigenous people. Settlers who couldn't afford horses even adopted the form of riding on oxen to take their produce and purchase to and from markets. The Taupo house first built in Grahamstown, 1824. So you can see an early farmhouse. Notice there would be no interleading doors. If you wanted to go in the next room, you'd go out side and then go in the next room. They didn't waste space by putting inner doors. And, of course, they start in the early shelter, and then they start to build a bit more elaborately. And by the time you see at the bottom, you can start seeing, by 1824, some more advanced double-story houses. This house I've seen, I've been in. This is, in fact, a museum in Grahamstown High Street. Samuel Jeffreys Cottage, a stone-built cottage erected as early as 1824, still standing, in the area now known as Artificers Square on Settlers Hill in Grahamstown. In this area, 32 small lots were allocated to artisans who were allowed to leave their locations. This cottage was restored in 1970 for the preservation of the settler buildings in Grahamstown. I've seen this farm area in Thornhill as well. Thornhill, near the mouth of the Cowrie River in 1823, it attracted by the Cape Settlement Scheme, Christopher Thornhill formed a party, mostly families from his own estate, and his experiences as a farmer are seen in this picture of his new home just 3 years after his arrival in Algoa Bay. He's built this kind of farm out of the wilderness without any timber city, Home Depot, or any other kind of macro hardware store, nothing like that. But from the beginning, they were beset by war, cattle raids, hostile neighbors, crop disease, floods, and droughts. Many of the families retreated to the towns, particularly Port Elizabeth, East London, and Grahamstown, having lost everything that they'd built up in their farms, burned out by raids from the neighboring causa. In Quenor, Enor was one of the minor causa chiefs, whose warriors enjoyed the fruits of many minor raids made across the Kisikama and Fish Rivers. Their headgear is made from long black feathers from the wings of blue cranes. And to them, this was just great fun, affirmative shopping, going across the border and getting whatever had been built up or brought in by the 1820 settlers. So the young settler from England had to have his musket with him at all times. This was just like standard. And they thought they were retiring from the wars when it came to peaceful Eastern Cape, and discovered they were just going into a different type of war. Here's a scene of captured cattle being escorted back across the Kai River to the Cape from the book Sport and War by General Sir John Bissett. He served from age 15 in the frontier wars and decided to make the army his career, took part in a lot of actions, commanded the Cape Mounted Rifles, and served as Lieutenant Governor of the Cape by 1865. This is from his book and bringing back the cattle that had been stolen on an earlier raid. So many of these settlers had no agricultural background and just migrated to towns very quickly, where they became smiths and tailors and practiced the trades they'd learned in England. Grahamstown in particular developed into a trading and manufacturing centre, where axes and knives and blankets were exchanged for ivory and skins. And by the way, it wasn't long and Grahamstown was the second largest city in the Cape, which meant it was the second largest city in the whole of Southern Africa, Grahamstown. Tradespeople amongst the settlers produced metal implements, wagons and clothes, so people were delighted to come to Grahamstown for trading. And this is what Grahamstown looked like. Port Elizabeth and Port Alfred initially developed to service Grahamstown. Grahamstown was the main city and Port Elizabeth was just a port to help provide what they needed. And Grahamstown was the second largest city in the Southern Hemisphere. Grahamstown, the metropole of the eastern region of the Cape of Good Hope in 1833, just 13 years after the 1820 settlers arrived. The Drotsky is on the extreme right. That's now where you would say Rhodes University is basically situated. St. George's Church stands on the square. There's St. George's Church. Stands on the square in the other end of High Street. And Piet Retief's Mill, there's Piet Retief's Mill. Piet Retief, who didn't seem to learn from Captain Stockenstrom's experience and went to Ungundluwe and left his rifles outside the kraal. It's a long way to go to end up at the end of an assegai. And that's Grahamstown in 1833. The settlers made a significant contribution to South African society. They insisted on a free press, which they hadn't enjoyed in Britain, and there was no free press in South Africa. In fact, journalism in South Africa, and the freedom of the press begins with 1820 settlers. The VOC allowed no freedom of the press, and there was no journalism under them, and the British didn't tolerate freedom of the press either, before this, and the 1820 settlers fought for and achieved it within 5 years of arriving. Now, this is Salem, a little town, even to this day, village. And it hasn't changed much since this time, actually. Here's an engraving for Reverend Thornley Smith. Across the village green shows the Methodist manse on the right and the second chapel. So there's the manse, there's the chapel. You've got second chapel over there. Reverend Shaw built that, and The second church was erected in 1832. The church was built in 1850. And the Salem Academy. So here you've got the chapel. There's the manse. There's the chapel. There's the church. And then you've got the academy, the school, that was built. And William Matthews ran the school. And when the new church was built next door, the second chapel became a place of worship and a school for black people who had moved into the area, most of those being refugees who were fleeing from the Matabele. Oatlands Park, estate of Colonel Henry Somerset in Grahamstown. Again, you can see planting of trees, orderly hedgerows, organization, turning the wilderness into paradise. Fort Wilkeshire Barracks in 1828. The first fort was on a hilltop about 3 kilometers away. Here you can see a dozen or more wagons drawn up on the banks of the Kisikama River. The Africans with their goods are there for barter, assembled on the parade ground. In December 1836, the territory between the Kisikama and the Fish Rivers was handed to the Amakosa, and Colonel Harry Somerset was instructed to evacuate the artillery and carry away all that was useful before raising the defences of both forts to the ground and giving this territory to the Kosa, moving more and more into this area. Fort England Barracks as developed by 1830. The mess house in the foreground and the old Cape Corps barracks on corporate in the building beyond. So there's the old Cape Corps. Fort Brown on the hillside and the bridge over the Fish River, named after Lieutenant Brown, who was in command here during the Sixth Frontier War. Spot was known to earliest travellers as Hermanus Kroll. The Guntowner Barracks on the left were completed in 1838, part of a new plan for defence of the frontier ordered by Sir Benjamin D'Urban. After whom? Durban is named. The bridge, and Durbanville too. True. Also built by the Royal Engineers, complete 1848. The only known sketch of the first Methodist chapel, do you see here on the right, it says Old Wesleyan Chapel. So this was the first Methodist chapel on High Street in Grahamstown. Foundation stone laid 1821 on the 2nd of January. Reverend William Shaw preached the opening sermon 20th of November 1822. On the Silver Jubilee is 25 years, of the 1820s Methodist settlement, celebrated by laying of the foundation stone, the Commemoration Church, which I've been able to preach in Grahamstown, was in 1845, but then the War of the Axe intervened. And it wasn't until 24th of November 1850 that the opening ceremony could be performed 20 years later. 5 years later. It was meant to be on 25th anniversary. And this is the entrance to the commemorative Methodist Church. Another 1820 settler, interesting character. Henry Harrer Dugmore was ordained at an early age and served as a missionary on Mount Coke. In the 1834 war, he just managed to escape with his family before the mission was attacked. His Kosa hymns are still some of the best known in the language, and his reminiscences of an Albany settler have been widely quoted. Great pioneer missionary to the Kosa, and one of the reasons why Methodists Church is the most popular denomination amongst the Kosa to this day. You'll find more Kosas come from Methodist background and got the education in Methodist schools than any other. Thomas Pringle, now this is a pretty famous name, born in Laidlaw, educated at Kelso and Edinburgh University, undertook the responsibility of leader of the Pringle Party, 24 people, from Roxbyshire, located in a remote valley of the Bavians River. On the 17th of August 1822, he left the party to take up the appointment as the sub-librarian of the newly established South African Public Library, which is just off the gardens in Cape Town. As champion of the settlers, he left his mark in the annals of the colony, returned to England 1826, and became secretary to the Anti-Slavery Society under Sir Thomas Foxwell Buxton, who was the successor to William Wilberforce. Reverend William Shaw was converted shortly after joining the North York Militia when just 14 years old. So he's a soldier at age 14. That wasn't unusual. He is minister to the Wesleyan families immigrating to Cape. From their location in Salem, Shaw extended the work to the entire settlement, founded the heart of the Methodist movement in Grahamstown, turned his attention to Kosa tribes, and between 1824 and 1830 established 6 mission stations amongst their tribes. That's 1 mission station a year. That's phenomenal. St. George's Church, Grahamstown, which is today the cathedral, building was inaugurated in 1830. New church completed in 1912, incorporated the south wall and the buttresses of the old church. And this is St. George's today. The commercial hall in Grahamstown, foundation stone laid with great ceremony in 1833. Long procession proceeded to St. George's Church, where a sermon was preached by Reverend Heaviside. I wonder how he got that name. St. John's Church in Bathurst, built with Bathurst freestone, together with many other settler churches, it testifies to the faith of the Christian pioneers and the spiritual strength they received. When war broke out, and there was non-stop wars, these frontier wars, in 1834, they surrounded this church with a lager of ox wagons, and it became a place of refuge for the women and children. And in 1846, again, it withstood siege, and about 300 people were encamped in the area enclosed by the earthen redoubt outside, linking it with the Wesleyan chapel. So the churches became sanctuaries during the times of war because they were built with solid stone and could provide serious protection. Here's one of the many peace talks with the Khoisan chiefs near Burns Hill in 1836. Masho, the principal settlement of the Barolong tribe known as the Mashos, north of Kuruman, seen above, and then you see Litaku, which is now known as Kuruman below. There's the Kuruman mission station, which is where David Livingston began his work. This is where Robert Moffat began and ended his work. Kuruman was the life's work of Robert Moffat in particular. And so these were the kind of mission stations that won whole tribes to Christ ultimately. Witnesses who gave evidence before the Select Committee on Aborigines sat in London in 1835. You can see Jan Tazazo on left to Andreas Stoffels seated, Jay Reed, senior and junior, and Dr. Phillips sitting on the far right. Reverend Andreas Stoffels won a round of applause when he said, "I stand before you as the fruit of your exertions," meaning of missionary labours. Jan Tazazo said he was chief of the Tindies. He learned to read and write at Bethelsdorp under the late Dr. van der Kemp. Colesberg in 1844, town named after Governor Sir Lowry Cole. In 1830 they named it after him, but this is in 1844. Surrounded by dolerite copies, with the Toverberg towering in the background, on the extreme right of the town is the gabled Store Dak Kerk. That should be over here. That's the thatched roof church. Craddock in 1848, around the marketplace stood several fine stores and private homes of the English or ornamented Dutch architecture. Some of these were completely destroyed in the flood of 1974. To think it survived all that time and then it got flood. But it looks like it's built in something of a valley. That's never a good idea when you think of floods. According to genealogist Shelley O'Brien Spencer, among the 1820 settlers who moved to Natal were John Bailey, the founder of East London, and Charles Kestell, after his son, the Reverend John Daniel Kestell of the Anglo-Boer War fame, the Free State town of Kestell is named. Now, if you go to the Women's Monument in the Anglo-Boer War Museum in Bloemfontein, there are only four men, there are only three men, and there are two women buried at the actual monument. Of course, Emily Hobhouse. And then also Mrs. Steyn, that's the Prime Minister of the Orange, or President of the Free State. Then you get three men buried at the Women's Monument. Christian de Wet, he is the military leader. President Steyn, he's the political leader. And J.D. Kestell, he's the spiritual leader. He's the chaplain of the Orange Free State. So interesting that even the chaplain of the Orange Free State forces came from 1820 settler stock. Surprising. The 1820 settlers contributed greatly to the development and economic progress of the Eastern Cape. And here's one of the monuments dedicated by State President C.R. Swart back in the 1960s. I've got this phenomenal book out of which I've gotten a lot of these materials, 1820 Settlers Illustrate Commentary. It's important to remember that the British settlers succeeded in establishing a free press, similar to the one they had in England, and by 1825, they'd managed to put enough pressure on the Cape government to allow it or recognize it. Here's a wooden printing press in use in 1824. Although iron hand presses were introduced after 1803, they only had a wooden printing press in Grahamstown. Now, this is the same kind of wooden printing press on which the commercial advertiser was printed, was like this. It was lent to George Greek by Reverend Dr. John Phillips, a London missionary site. He provided the printing press on which the first newspapers in South Africa were printed. Facsimile of the first issue of the South African Commercial Advertiser, editor George Greek, 1824. And George Greek claimed to have been trained in His Majesty's printing office in London, and he sold his interest to John Fairbairn. So John Fairbairn came to South Africa in 1823 at the invitation of Thomas Pringle. He formed a friendship at Edinburgh University with him. He became the dominating influence in South African journalism during the next 30 years. From 1854 to 1863, he represents Swellendam in the Legislative Assembly in Cape Town, what today is our Parliament. The South African Commercial Advertiser was South Africa's first independent newspaper. First appeared January 1824, weekly publication, and when the fiscal, meaning the Cape government, exerted its right to see proofs before publication and be in a position to censor articles dealing with political and personal topics, the editors decided to discontinue publication protest and publish this, which are distributed freely, facts connected with the stopping of the South African Commercial Advertiser, and enlisted why it is wrong, immoral, unethical, unjust, against Magna Carta, all arrest, for any government to want to censor any publications of free speech. There's a few of these copies still in existence. And here's the first newspaper in the Eastern Province, the Grahamstown Journal, an account of fancy ball given by the officers of His Majesty's 98th Regiment in 1832, records the Zulu Majesty Dingaan laying aside his Askan shield and footing it with a pretty Welsh peasant. That's the kind of thing that made the news at that stage. And here's where they did the printing. A building that was upgraded in 1869, Grootvet's Mail. Now, you can speak to Tarrant, who studied as a journalist at Rhodes University. Rhodes University's got the finest journalism faculty in the country, I believe. And Rhodes University Journalism Department bought up Grootvet's Mail and the advertiser, and their journalism students have the chance of writing articles for the oldest newspaper in the country, which is quite a nice touch in journalism training. Interesting, when I looked at this and was speaking to Karen about it, I realized that's the very print shop I walked into as a soldier in 1980 to get our A1 posters printed for the Roger Voke Evangelist of Grayley and 1820 Settlers Monument for a big crusade. And interesting, that is the birthplace of journalism and free press in South Africa today. And while this is an upgrade from the original building, it's the same location. Facsimile of Robert Godlinton's own copy of his narrative of the Sixth Frontier War. And he wrote a whole lot of accounts of the wars. And he, in fact, went to partnership as proprietor with the newspaper in 1834 as well. So this is what Grahamstown would have looked like at that stage. And here you've got the church. This is from the other side, though. This is now with 1820 settlers, where it would be again to your right, and the Drotsky directly behind you, which is today Rhodes University. Grootvet's Mail would be on the other side of this cathedral, and the Methodist Church would be on the other side. The 6th South African Infantry Battalion would be on the left-hand side on the hill. So here you can see what this looks like today, coming into Grahamstown, and this is now on the other side of it, looking now on the far side. You'd have the actual Drotsky, where the Rhodes Memorial is on that side. Here's the Methodist Church spire. There's the Anglican Church spire. So Grootvet's Mail is just a bit to the left here. The fear of the Lord is a fountain of life. A drinking fountain in Church Square, Grahamstown, unveiled in 1862, the Grahamstown Journal report, the fountain is a chaste and unpretending piece of sculpture. The design was modified from one erected in the north of England, and the material used being the best stone obtainable in the vicinity of the city. And you can read on here, the fear of the Lord is a fountain of life. And quoting from Proverbs. And it's still there. And something that I would see regularly going into Grahamstown. Magnificent church. This is the church of St. Michael and St. George. Also commemorated at the Voortrekker Monument is when the Voortrekkers left Grahamstown, the settlers in Grahamstown, the English settlers, presented a Bible. And here's the Bible presented to Jacobus Ace when his party of trekkers, of about 100 people, left Grahamstown on their trek north, April 1837. Commemorated in stone and marble in the Voortrekker Monument. The inscription inside the Bible reads, "This sacred book is presented to Mr. Jacobus Ace and his departing countrymen by the inhabitants of Grahamstown in its vicinity as a farewell token of esteem and heartfelt regret at their departure." It's a remarkable thing that the Boers in the frontier areas and the 1820 settlers became good friends, good neighbors, sympathetic, supportive, and completely understood the motives of one another because they were facing the same problems. And the settlers in the Eastern Cape sympathized with the trekkers and in no way were against them leaving, except they were sad to see them go and also that their frontier defenses were being depleted. But they had no criticisms of them leaving because they also had the same criticisms for the Cape government, who were not protecting them, who were continually kowtowing to the aggressors, not blaming the settlers whose farms were being burned and whose cattle were being stolen and whose family members were being murdered, and continually taking the side of the aggressors and the invaders and the arsonists, just like governments today. And so the 1820 settlers were no illusions that the Boers had very good cause for their protest and for the great trek, and they showed great solidarity with them. And this is honoured in the Voortrekker Monument, and this is honoured in the 1820 Settlers Book 2. Mr. Hume's wagons at Grahamstown Market, 1850. He is barely 19 when he came to South Africa in 1817, but 8 years later he is trading as far north as Bechuanaland, what today is Botswana. And by 1830 he had secured permission from Mzilikazi to prospect for gold on the Limpopo. His good relations with Mzilikazi made him a valuable guide to missionaries like Robert Moffat and explorers like Andrew Smith and Robert Moffat's son, John Moffat, who started the first mission station amongst the Matabele. So Benjamin de Urban, who is the one after whom Durban and Durbanville is named, on his arrival he is faced with internal problems from the emancipation of the slaves, while on the frontier new invasion was threatening. During the war he personally directed the offensive, and on 10th of May 1835, while encamped on the banks of the Kai, he decided to annex the territory between the Fish and the Kai rivers and named it the province of Queen Adelaide. Hence we have Adelaide County. Have you ever been to the town of Harry Smith? Was named after this man, Harry Smith. Smith was gazetted as 2nd Lieutenant in 95th Regiment in 1805 during the Napoleonic Wars, served 21 years with his old corps before being posted to the Cape of Good Hope, 1829. He was Deputy Quartermaster General of the Queen's Army in India and then returned in 1847 as Governor and Commander-in-Chief until 1852. And if you wonder who Lady Smith is named after, it's this lady, Lady Smith, Harry Smith's wife, who he met during his wars, and she followed him on all his campaigns and even to his battles. She was inseparable with her husband, even though he was a very hands-on soldier who was frequently in the front line fighting with every kind of enemy from the Spanish onwards. Here's a quote from this book, 1820 Settlers. "In their stark ignorance, they made some pitiful blunders, but inevitably they learned the hard way, by blood and sweat and tears. Nothing could daunt the indomitable spirit, and by grim determination and steadfast courage and high endeavor, they triumphed over every obstacle. In the highest councils of the land, in the business and cultural development of the towns and cities, and in the pastoral and agricultural expansion of the country, they have left a name which shall never perish." This is a very magnificent monument in Grahamstown on a hill overlooking by the 1820 settlers' monument of this man and woman, well-dressed, cultured, with their daughter coming to a dangerous land and with a Bible in the father's hands. So if you go to the buildings. The buildings show you so much. Just to see how magnificently they built this church. They didn't build some prefab or something with wooden thatch. They built this to last for generations past themselves, past their grandchildren, great-grandchildren's age. And I've been in this church a number of times, and again, what's very popular with the Anglicans in particular is the bird who feeds her chicks from her own blood, takes blood from herself and feeds the chicks, symbolic of Christ's sacrifice, that we are nurtured by the blood of Christ. And the wooden artwork, sketchings, etchings around the pulpit, you can see tremendous insights here. This is the throne of a bishop. Of course, a city is where there's a cathedral, and a cathedral is where there's the chair, and that's the bishop's chair. Again, the symbolism of that. Beautiful stained glass windows, great artwork, not our style, but it indicates the faith of the Anglican community came there. Grahamstown is named as the Cathedral of St. Michael and St. George. Now, we know who St. George was. St. George, it's the St. George's cross that makes up the flag of England. St. George is attributed with killing dragons. Now, he didn't go for rare reptiles. He was fighting against evil. He was rescuing damsels in distress. He was a brave knight. And St. Michael is the archangel who fights Satan and who will one day bind Satan and throw away the key kind of thing. So St. Michael and St. George. There's a lot of history in these cathedrals. This is the plan model of the cathedral initially. And there's memorials all around the cathedral to different people who've died in action. A died age 32. And again, people who were killed in battles in memory of Colonel John Graham, Commandant of Simonstown, who actually laid out, chose the site, and after whom Grahamstown's named. In memory of those who died in the First World War, in this case in East Africa. What is death but one last intimate adventure? Often we would have military parades right outside the church here on this square. You've got a lot of commemorative stamp editions. Just look at the great artwork. And here again, remembering those who died in the First World War. These memorials. And monuments are testimonies in stone. The Methodist Church, outside the Methodist Memorial Church, where we've had church services, you have the laying of the memorial for those who died in the Second World War. And here you've got a monument where the crown of the martyr's crown is being offered above for the fallen soldier. And again, they've got different memorials for different battles on the frontier and so on. 1820 settlers were commemorated by postage stamps before, but I haven't noticed them commemorating it this year. In fact, I haven't noticed anything commemorating the 1820 settlers this year. And when I went online to try and find some audio, some video, some picture, some article, nothing, which convinced me we needed to dedicate a Reformation Society evening to 1820 settlers.
I also thought about that earlier in the year.
And 200th anniversary.
And I found the association for the British settlers or some group.
There's a settlers association.
And they had the different families were having church services.
Yes.
Over the last 2 months.
And unfortunately, obviously it's been frustrated. They had plans, but it's been savagely sidelined, derailed by the lockdown. So the British 1820 settlers are commemorated primarily by the 1820 settlers monument, which was unveiled in 1974. And notice it's built like a ship, because they came by ship. And it's actually quite an interesting design. And in keeping with the British commercial nature of the settlers, this is a commercial living memorial, which isn't just a monument. It's not just a museum. It's a place for cultural events, and they have all kinds of arts and crafts and camps, conferences, seminars. Many things go on there. And I don't know about this modern art up front, but still. This monument is dedicated to the memory of the settlers of 1820 and later British immigrants. Its auditorium, lecture halls, and other facilities are open to all to enjoy and enlarge our heritage of language and culture and to perpetuate our traditions of tolerance and freedom of speech. It needs to be remembered that the 1820 settlers brought with them an insistence on a free press, freedom of speech, freedom of conscience, freedom of religion, freedom of belief, freedom of association, and they fought for those. And they got themselves on the wrong side of the government all the time. But it's something that we can all benefit from if we insist. Nor wild romance nor pride allured me here. Duty and destiny with equal voice constrained my steps. I had no other choice, something for Africa to do or say. That's a quote from Pringle. Doug Moore said to his party, "We must take root and grow or die where we stand." They didn't have another choice. The ships brought them, dropped them off, left. There they were. You can stay with the tents by the sand in this windswept place, or you can go in and learn to farm and survive. They've got a scaffolding type structure inside the 1820 settlers monument that immediately you notice the St. George's Cross of the English flag and the St. Andrew's Cross of Scotland, which makes the Union Jack. But then you see at the base there's a fountain. What is this fountain for? Have life, that all may have life and have it more abundantly. They've got a sort of fountain flame in the middle, and they've got the scripture from John chapter 10. Jesus said, "I've come that they may have life and may have it more abundantly." Wonderful to think that they used to make monuments honoring God and the Christian faith. Now, you go there, this is a few years ago, went and with my son Calvin and we took pictures, and yep, there's a lot of modern art here. I suppose that's it's an artistic place. We went also to the auditorium. Now, the auditorium is remembered by me to be a scene of the final service of our 20 years ago when we had the Grahamstown Evangelistic Mission, and I hired out this venue, bankrupted myself with my army pay, for Reverend Roger Vogt to preach here to 1,000 people. It could accommodate 1,100 people, and this is where Roger Vogt gave his last sermon, and it was really, really powerful. Fort Selwyn is also part of the 1820 settlers monument complex. It's one of the actual forts which has been preserved, which was needed to protect Grahamstown from attacks. And Grahamstown was attacked on numerous occasions and attacked with fire and burned down a lot. Notice the cross-like signal. That's one way how they serampored. They signaled to other forts by either flags or by the positions of these signs, so they could communicate some basic things quickly, and of course using different serampore signals. This Fort Selwyn is now a national monument, built during 1835-1836 as part of the Cape Colony military defense structure, named after Major Selwyn, who was the one responsible for building it. Of course, the kind of artillery they would have had at that stage, we're looking towards where my old military base would have been, just behind on the hill over there. That whole area there would be roughly where, just beyond the horizon, is where the 6th South African Infantry Battalion was, where we held that Grahamstown Evangelistic Mission. And in happier days when there were more trees. But you can see, in recent years, when I was in Grahamstown, you couldn't have seen any of this because there's forest on every side, all over the place. You couldn't have seen any of those hills for all the forests. But somehow or another, this government can't seem to deal with litter or something, but boy, can they chop down millions of trees. Because they're alien trees, apparently. This is the way I remember 1820 Settlers Monument. Just forest all around on every side, and just like a ship coming out of the ocean on the crest of the wave. And down below is Rhodes University. And you go through these gates into what should be a place of higher learning. And Taryn studied here, journalism, and got me back there as a guest speaker, and I must say, when I was in the 6th South African Infantry, would regularly run a Bible study downtown amongst the students at Rhodes University too. There were some nice people there, some good memories. This monument is dedicated to the memory of the British settlers of 1820 and the many other pioneers who are buried here. There's something else interesting up on the hill by 1820 Settlers Monument, and it looks like some kind of, is this Stonehenge or something? No, it's actually remembering, it's to do with the sun, the winter solstice, 21st of June. The summer solstice on the 22nd of December. And then they've got this plaque from Psalm 19. The heavens declare the glory of God. The vault of heaven proclaims his handiwork. Day discourses of it today. Night to night, hands on the knowledge. No utterance at all. No speech, no sound that anyone can hear. Yet their voice goes out through all the earth and their message to the ends of the earth. And that from Psalm 19. Magnificent. Well, that's appropriate because the 1820 settlers were overwhelmingly dedicated Christians. Today, the descendants of these pioneers make up an important minority group in South Africa. They played a significant role in the development of South Africa for the good, and we should be grateful for that heritage. There have been attempts to commemorate the 1820 settlers, but not much this year. There's a phenomenal book that came out this year, massive book, which is the most comprehensive geological study of the 1820 settlers and as many of their stories and where they came from and where they're going to commemorate the 200th anniversary. And I feel so sorry for them that this lockdown has doubtless inhibited the promotion of this book and these events. So may God use this presentation, which we'll put in audio and video and PowerPoint on the web, for us to be able to promote it. But now I'd like to teach you a song, which I need to learn too. I need to learn it by going to, there we go. I must get our Maxman on and listen to this hymn that somebody composed, not somebody, she's got a name, Miriam Erasmus. You can get this on the 1820settlers.com website, but I've got the... I think that's quite magnificent, isn't it? So, there are great resources. We've got our book on Sketches on South African History, but there's so much more we need to learn. This we'll make available in our library. How would you like us to stand and try to sing that hymn? We've got the words, and I will activate this again so that we've got some music coming around. Want to try? Let's stand. 1890, on Britain's gallant shores, the people were suffering after many bloody wars. There wasn't much employment, and life was hard and grim. But down in the Cape they were short of men, so they sent civilians in. There's trouble in the colony, our soldiers cannot cope. We'll send a band of settlers in, that is our only hope. We'll offer them a future and 100 acres of ground. In all of Britain in these hard times, I'm sure the men can be found. You gentlemen of Britain, I'll have you gathered near, the grandest proclamation you quickly shall hear. The government are asking for men both brave and true. If you sail away to the Cape in the south, there's 100 acres for you. Now 90,000 people soon answered to the call. Alas, cried the government, we cannot send you all. There's room for but 5,000 men, women, and children too. And the lofty ships lie waiting in dock, for they are to transport you. There's carpenters and blacksmiths and silversmiths as well. There's officers and soldiers just freshly out of hell. From Ireland, Wales, and Scotland, and England they came. Tailors, clockmakers, journeymen, farmers, professional men were game. We'll leave behind our homelands, our families and friends. We're bound to settle in that land where Africa does. We're brave and gallant heroes, we'll do the best we can. We'll raise the flag of the red, white, and blue, and we'll prosper in that land. Thank you. Please be seated. Right, any comments or questions? Comments or questions?
Well, what was the Secretary of Colonies at that time? It was a clever plan.
That's a good question. It would be past the time of Lady Anne Barnett's husband, because he was, and he was only of the Cape. It was a good plan from their perspective, but the poor souls who got suckered into this, they really were in for a bit of a nightmare in many cases. It was not an easy route.
But I mean, they were giving away land that they didn't possess, so they were using those people to actually gain the land.
Well, most of the lands in these areas were very unoccupied and just open. Yes, as I said, they were ploughing land that hadn't been ploughed since the time of Noah.
They were claiming it for them, for Britain.
They were creating a buffer for their colony, basically. Well, because when you build a nice farm and you've got lots of cattle, sheep, and so on, then covetous eyes from across the river may decide they want to come and do some affirmative shopping. Yes, they did, because it was unoccupied. And, well, bear in mind, everybody is a settler. The Khoisan were coming down from the north. In fact, originally, the Khoisan people, who were the original inhabitants of the Cape, their civilization went all the way up to East Africa. You can get their rock paintings from Kenya all the way down. But the only place that exists now is in the Cape, some parts of Namibia and of Botswana, because everywhere else they were exterminated. The Bantu tribes that came down exterminated the Hottentots, the Bushmen, the Khoisan people. And the only place where the Khoisan survived is where they found protection behind Christian settlers. That's just the fact of everywhere in history people have migrated. Unless you're born in the Garden of Eden, everyone is a migrant and a settler, or their ancestors are. And so when you think that there was overpopulation and starvation in Europe and other places, and people were moving away to find land to farm, that's how Australia got settled. That's how America got settled. That's how Zululand got settled. The Zulus were also settlers. The Matabele say they moved in and took the area they did because they were stronger than the tribes up there. The Mashona, you can go to the Zimbabwe textbooks today. Zimbabwe textbooks say the Shona were able to beat the original inhabitants there, the Karanga people, because they had superior weapons and tactics. So it is the Maori aren't the original inhabitants of New Zealand. The Maori ate the original inhabitants of New Zealand. The Indians in North America weren't the originals. They exterminated the people that were there originally. So you've got, if you go back further, you find there's been continually wars and movements. But when there's empty land not being used, it's too much to expect others not to want to come and use it. And if the people from Europe hadn't done it, maybe the folks from China or Saudi Arabia would. And they wouldn't treat people quite as nicely.
And as you say, apart from the Khoisan, there was no one there. And then the whites were moving up, and the blacks were moving down, and they met at the Fish River.
Yes.
And that was where it started.
That's where it started indeed.
Yeah. But there was no one there before then. I mean, they were moving.
Yes. So, for example, in 1890, when the pioneer column of Cecil Rhodes moved into what today is called Zimbabwe, what then was called Matabeleland, Mashonaland, there were between 80,000 and 100,000 people in the entire what today is called Zimbabwe, 80 to 100,000 max. That's pretty empty. And when you think we've got 4.5 million people in the Cape Peninsula right now. Now, bear in mind, when I was born, 1960, Cape Town's population was about 230,000.
They had around 6.7 million.
Really? That much?
Yeah.
It's hard for me to keep track. But I know this much. I and my sons and daughters are amongst the minority of people in Cape Town who can say we were born in Cape Town. Most people in Cape Town today moved here. From where? I mean, almost everywhere in the world, people moved from somewhere, or their ancestors did. So this idea that some are settlers, the fact is, how can white people be settlers and colonials, but black people who've just moved in from, whether it's Transkei, Congo, or Nigeria, well, what are they? They're also colonials and settlers. So you get some settlers and colonials who come and bring skills and build up the place, and you get others who come and burn things down. And so there's a big difference between the quality of one person's contribution to society and the quality of another. Now, the millennials of this world haven't produced much, but they've destroyed things. They're those people who build, and you've got to say that someone like Shaka Zulu, he built a kingdom, he built an empire. And the Zulus are just to be proud of what the Zulu people achieved militarily and other ways. And they celebrate 200 years of the Kingdom of Zululand just recently. And here we've been in the Cape nearly 400 years. And yet, it's like you're settlers. You know, the mentality is not balanced or rational.
But the thing is, we are propagandized from since 1994. before.
Mm. Yeah.
Before, but it's got yes. worse and worse.
Now it's official. Yeah. Yes.
I grew up, I'm the oldest person here, I think. I'm 60 and I'm turning 61. And I grew up in the old South Africa. We were taught all of this history in standard 3 and 4, that's 6 and 7. Oh, you're the oldest man. From grade 5 to 7,
yes.
It was our history. We learned about every war we had to. Come on, some other people must have learned it too. But
yeah.
we had to know about every war and what was after it. We had to know what the settlers were given from the government, the implements. We had to learn that.
Yeah, not that they were actually given it. We've discovered since they were sold it on credit. They had to pay it back later.
Yeah.
Nothing
we
was free.
I remember we had to make a list of what they were given, you know, in our test.
Yes.
So that type of thing. So, yeah, that is our background, and that was taken completely out of the curriculum, so.
Went down the memory hole.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but when the Boer trekkers reached the Transvaal, there was no one there. The Mazlakazi killed everybody every time.
Basically, yeah. There's no structure.
They suffered greatly under the Tsetse fly and things like this, but there wasn't a single human being alive in the Transvaal.
They moved into empty areas.
Every tribe that there was.
And once they got settled, people came from other areas to find protection or work or food or help or whatever they may have needed. Yeah, there's also a right of conquest in that Mzilikazi, who had conquered others, he got conquered. Mzilikazi then moved north. Yeah, so there's rights of you know, possession is 19th law, but then there's also the right of conquest, and they beat another conqueror. But treated the people better.
All the cities, all the big towns, they were built by the trekkers, by the white people. Let's put it like that. If you look at Bloemfontein.
Well, Malema now calls them thieves, the ones who built it.
Pretoria is now Swanee. Who built Pretoria? You know, Pretoria.
Not Swanee.
Fought at Blatronach. He was the leader, and it was his. What he's done and he's people for his people, and they went back off in the Republic of Natalia.
Yes, I think if someone wants to build a town to honor Swanee, they should build him a town to honor Swanee, but you don't rename something someone else has built. Same thing with the Huguenot Tunnel. They wanted to rename the Huguenot Tunnel the Dalai Lama Tunnel. Said, well, build Dula Omar a tunnel. Don't steal one that's been made in honor of the Huguenots. And this is the thing, again, we had Settlers Way. Why was Settlers Way renamed by Cruella de Vil Nelson Mandela Boulevard? Build Nelson Mandela a road. Don't steal another road that other people built and paid for and name it after someone else. That's just dishonest. It's like for me to buy and give my wife an engagement ring means something. To steal an engagement ring from someone else is not quite the same thing.
Yeah, but it was the whole Marxist ideology to replace the history with the new angles of history.
Any other comments? Questions? Yes.
So when did the... I know there's a group of Boers who went back to Argentina.
Yeah, well, gee, that's another kind of trick, isn't it?
No, they
I don't know about
they
them.
They went there after the Anglo Boer War because they wanted to leave. They didn't want to be under the British. So they went to Argentina, where people were happy to receive them.
Mm.
And then they became obviously Spanish.
If I know there's also a documentary or a book about them as well.
They didn't go back there, they left
to go and see. Interestingly enough too, there were Boers who fled from the British rule to German Southwest Africa, and after the British took Southwest Africa, went to Angola.
Yes.
And after Angola fell from the Portuguese, many of their descendants came back. There were also some Boers who went as far as Tanganyika. And again, when Tanganyika was owned, they came back in 1962 or so. There were also those who went to what today is Zimbabwe, and when Rhodesia fell, moved back. So there were some Boers who went a lot further. Yes. And by the way, do you know, you can find Zulus in Malawi and Zambia today. I meet people who, they're Zulus, and they're Zulu tribes still there. They're some of the Matabele who kept fighting, and it didn't stop, and they went all the way up. Katima Malelo in Caprivi is a Zulu name. And so Katima Malelo was also established by Zulu warriors, actually Matabele by then, who'd kept gone that far. So they went pretty far as well. The diaspora of warrior people is always further than most. Yes. Well, the Khoza was like a rival tribe, and they certainly had some battles, but because they were in the eastern parts of South Africa, they fought the Swazis, they fought all the other tribes around what inhabited Natal, wiped them out, and of course the Matabele section of the Zulu went up through Transvaal, the Free State and Transvaal, and all the way into what's now Zimbabwe. So they didn't, they for some reason didn't go south towards the Khoza. If they had, history would be very different. If they had gone towards the Khoza, I think one thing is there's just a lot of rivers flowing out of the Drakensberg, a lot of rivers to cross to get into Transkei, and from both sides. The Drakensberg's the Dragon Mountains. I mean, that's really a major obstacle.
But the Khoza Nguni group came first. They settled.
Yes.
They went furthest and they settled first.
Yes.
And then the Zulus came. It's a similar group, but they
linguistically there's similarity.
But
yes.
They came at a later stage.
Mm. Yeah. Right.
That is why that book is.
Well, I'll trust a Zulu or Matabele, but yeah, we've got reservations about some others. You know, in Europe, you've got these different stereotypes which often have a basis of truth to it. That, you know, the Swiss are precise, but they're quite cold. The French are great cooks, and, you know, the Italians are bad soldiers, and the Germans are precision, and the British are terrible cooks, but they've got this reputation for fairness as policemen, which turns out not to be actually true. This, what did Napoleon call England? Nation of shopkeepers, and things like that. So there's stereotypes of different groups, and some of it's true. There's always exceptions, but nationally, you get, the Bible even says all Cretans are liars. So, you know, you've got certain types of characteristics, not only of individuals. Obviously, we can rise above it by the grace of God. We can break free of, we might come from a family of criminals and so on. And like Chicago Airport's named after their hero, whose father was one of Al Capone's criminals. And yet he became a war hero in the Second World War, saved a whole aircraft carrier with his phenomenal achievements in the air. He died in the war, but they named Chicago's airport after the son of one of Al Capone's criminals, but he broke free from it.
Jacob. I was going to ask about, there was one evening here that you mentioned diaries of, I'm sure I can still remember, and you said you still have some of the diaries of the farmers, you know, the boere that actually wrote diaries, and you unfortunately got hold of those diaries after they were actually thrown out.
Okay, I'm talking now about the Erfenis Centrum in the Voortrekker Monument. At the Voortrekker Monument, they've got a phenomenal, they've got thousands of diaries and other irreplaceable materials. And so they when I looked at this, and they took me into their vault, which is phenomenal library, and it's air conditioned, controlled temperature, halon gas protected, that if there's any sign of fire and so on, how to protect these things. Where did you get these from? He said you'd weep if you knew. We were contacted by someone saying they're throwing everything out of Central Pretoria Library and so on. They went and they got them out the dumpsters. They were throwing them out, and some were going to be pulped and burned. And same thing out at Hermanus. You go to Hemingway's, which is one of the finest second-hand bookshops in Western Cape. Where did you get these books from? Dumpsters on the way to getting pulped out of Cape Town Central Library. They're just throwing out leather-bound, original, first edition stuff. And yes. Now, one of our prized books, which is worth a few thousand dollars on Amazon, we've got a first edition of David Livingstone's travels, Livingstone Travels, came out in 1856. And that book has got on the front inside cover stamped discarded by University of Tennessee. I could see when I got it, it had written in the top corner $2. So the University of Tennessee threw out this book, literally, and it was sold in some bookshop for $2. Friend of America saw it, bought it for me, and shipped it to me, and thank you very much. I mean, this is a first edition, but we've got quite a few first editions that were thrown away by different people, and it's, for the person who gets it, that's great, but the society as a whole has lost this treasury because they've just thrown out tens of thousands of great books. And anyway, the Fort Trickle Monument has acquired many of these great diaries, manuscripts, memoirs, they've got some of the original title deeds and transfer documents and so many things. It's just a vital part of our heritage, which also goes against the lies of these people stole the land or whatever and things like that. And you can see, well, this is what they paid for it and this is what the arrangements were and this is how it was signed and sealed and organized. And that's why you can have groups like AfroForum say, can you point to one single case of any South African farmer who's stolen his land? And they offered a very big reward, and I don't think anyone's ever tried to claim it. Because it's a nice narrative for a communist, but it's without basis. So, any other comments, questions, observations?
Just about throwing out things and so on. You know the story about the Dead Sea Scrolls, I'm sure. That the two kids or two young people found it. And the one thought, well, this will make nice shoes. Nice leather scrolls, but, you know. So they actually took them to the one shoemaker in Jerusalem somewhere, and they said, "Look, we've got some nice leather here. Can you make some shoes for us?" And he said, "I think I must contact someone who knows something about old documents. We might be able to get you some shoes from somewhere else."
Originally, they were using vellum, which is calf leather, to write scriptures on. Preserves, but that's seriously valuable. And of course,
the usual kosher.
Any other comments on 1820 settlers? Yes.
I have a burning question regarding truth. As short as I can, I talk a lot sometimes. But in the absolute importance for individuals to do their own research nowadays, obviously the fruits of truth is evidence. What is your way that you lead a lot of these Reformation societies, in which you maybe some practical advice that you can provide for us to test truth and evidence?
That's a good point. Our Lord said, "You will know the truth will set you free." First thing is, we know that the gold standard for truth is the Bible, the Word of God. Jesus said, "I am the truth." And we must have our minds renewed by the washing of the Word. So the Word of God gives us truth. Now, we need wisdom. Proverbs is wisdom. The Word of God is truth and wisdom. Now, when it comes to understanding truth in our lifetime, it's also always got to be tested against the Word of God's principles. So what you sow is what you reap. You can't expect pure water to come from a polluted spring and so on. Bad tree bears bad fruit. You can tell by the fruit sometimes where the root is. If a person claims you're a born-again, Bible-believing, evangelical Christian who loves the Lord and who fears God, but you can see malice, hatred, jealousy, envy, strife, bitterness, well, that's the fruit of the flesh. It's not the fruit of the Spirit. Something's wrong here. If you see water flowing uphill, you know, there has to be a pump. Water cannot flow uphill. There's gravity. So if you see water flowing uphill, you don't need to see the pump to know there must be a pump. Because it's not natural that water can defy gravity and flow uphill. So again, there's our worldview and our understanding of how things work and the laws of God should set us up to recognize that good does not come out of evil. And so on. Now, first-hand eyewitness key. Out of the mouth of two or three witnesses, everything will be accepted. But watch out. Sometimes these witnesses are not eyewitnesses. They're all quoting one another. And you can sometimes get, for example, just give you a classic example. When I was your age, we were beset with stories of Nelson Mandela's come to Christ in jail, and he's about to die. He's old man, he's sick man, he's about to die, and it's going to be catastrophe. The whole country will go aflame if he dies in prison. Anyway, he's come to Christ and he's born again. Well, this story was great. Billy Graham was saying, before Mandela was released from jail, Mandela's given his life to Christ in prison. He's a Christian, dedicated Christian. People worship him, people are counseled to Christ to get the stories. And the story was all over the place. We heard it from so many. And Africa Enterprise, Michael, who runs Africa Enterprise? Africa Enterprise. Michael, yeah. Anyway, he was talking about it too. This was so popular, it was a popular thing. Well, Mandela comes out of prison, not a word of giving honor to God. Actually, he came from Methodist background. He's causer. So he was brought up in a village where almost everyone was Methodist. But when I asked him, what's his relationship with God? He said, don't want to answer that. That's a private question. And when I asked if I could pray for him, he didn't want to.
Yeah. I am a scientific materialist.
Yeah. Well, he is a hardcore Marxist atheist for sure. But the point is that when Mandela came out of prison, not a word of honor to the Lord, not a prayer, not a Bible verse, nothing. So we wrote to Africa Enterprise saying, where did this come from when you said Mandela's a Christian? Oh, well, we got this from Billy Graham. So we wrote to Billy Graham Association. Oh, well, we got this from Africa Enterprise. Yeah, they were quoting one another. Nobody was willing to take responsibility for the source, but there was even more involved. It was actually quite a chain. And you get these stories. I had, again, when Chris Harney was killed, 1993, and I just debated him literally a few weeks before in Washington, D.C., and he swore at me and said, I am an atheist. Well, the moment he got killed, they start coming, you know, he was going to testify, he had come to Christ, he's testifying of his conversion at UCT the next week and so on and so forth. Well, it just happened that I'd spoken to him, so I knew firsthand, eyeball to eyeball, the man's an atheist, and I'd heard what he had to say about everything. So I then checked with UCT. He was going to speak at UCT on my journey from faith to atheism. That was the title of his message. And somebody turned it into, he's a Christian, he's testing me and so on. Well, when you dug into it, you found it's all disinformation. So you can hear a story, and the story might even sound believable, but when you dig, what's the source? And what's that source's source? And what are they basing it on? And does it gel with the evidence? This, to me, is key. You're hearing so many different stories all the time, and remember, there's whole industries of disinformation, just creating and publishing disinformation. So it's important for us to check sources and get from eyewitnesses. So take another thing which we've dealt with here at several times with Reformation Society, where I met Ian Smith, I knew Ian Smith, and therefore I heard from his mouth different things. And when I read in a book about Ian Smith said, did all this, well, I was brought up in Rhodesia and I knew him and my father knew him and so on. I'm going to take first hand over fifth hand in a journalist. When you get someone talking about the Second World War, a film from Hollywood, and my own father says it wasn't like that. And people I know at the Moths, who am I going to take? Some cocaine-sniffing drug addict in Hollywood who's probably a paedophile and a rapist and child abuser? Or do I take someone I know who in my lifetime I could speak to who actually went through then and had a different story? So basically, double-check. And I would say the other way is, and this is a great one I got from Albania. In Albania, I had this man give me an ice cream every day as I was walking to Derez to do the ministry and then back and past the great amphitheater where Titus was fed to the lions, martyred, in Illyricum. The same Titus that you read about in the Bible. So I asked this man, why are you giving me an ice cream? He said, you come from South Africa, very good country. How do you know South Africa is a good country? The communists tell us how terrible and evil you are every week. Have you ever heard anything good about us? Nothing. Only bad things. So that's why I know God has a great plan for you.
But we looked after their king for many years.
That's right. King Lekker. Yeah. Even got a wedding greetings from him because he is a friend of the Baffin family. So, King Lekker and Queen Susan. of the Albanians. So, and they lived in Transvaal, in exile. So I said to him, how do you know that South Africa is good people? He says, in our country we have one party, Communist Party, and they control everything, the media. So we know the media is the voice of the Communist Party. We know they lie. So whatever they say, we know that the opposite is true. Now, that's not a bad way of determining it. So when you find something popular in the world, remember all the verse in the Bible, Satan's deceiving the whole world, and one day an angel will bind Satan that he might deceive the nations no more. So all the warnings about do not be deceived, and Satan who deceives the whole world, and the God of this world has blinded the minds of those who do not love God. And therefore, if you find something that's been chanted by the whole world or believed by the bulk of the world, the UN, Hollywood and so on, you know it's false. Whether it's evolution, billions of years, whatever the story is, you know, there's 76 genders. How many are there? I've lost track now. So you know they're lying just from that side.